Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting across from Tony Park, who's come here to talk about his latest thriller, Captive. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks, John. It's great to be back here again.
It's so nice to sit across from someone of height. You're, what, 6'6"?
6'6". We don't have to bend down for each other.
Anything like that. It's fantastic. So your life is one of those lives that people read about and go, Jesus, what have I been doing with my life? You live half your time or some of your time in Australia, some of your time in South Africa, and go between, and you are now writing two best-selling thrillers every year. Do you have to pinch yourself and sort of go, how did this happen?
Yeah, quite often. It wasn't part of any grand plan that I had, that the only thing I ever knew in life from the time that I was a little kid was that I wanted to write a novel. It was the one thing in life that I wanted to do. I had no idea that I would end up writing books set in Africa, or that I would even travel to Africa. I grew up in Campbelltown in the western suburbs of Sydney, and there was nothing in my DNA or family or socioeconomic background that would indicate I'd ever get to travel, let alone write about other countries. But yeah, since my first novel, Far Horizon, came out back in 2004, my wife Nicola and I have literally lived half of our lives in Africa. We spend 6 months of every year off and on in Africa, and these days we have a house in South Africa, which is our base, and that's where I base myself when I'm writing the books and travel around Africa from there.
So someone who had, from an early age, I want to write a novel, you took the weirdest route to get there. Well, what's that about?
Very, very long route as well, too. Look, I think it's, if you have a dream and you want to follow it, I think people should, and I'm the first person to suggest that people do that. But I know it's not easy sometimes, you know. It would be very hard to wake up one day and say, I'm going to go and write a book now, because you need a couple of things that most of us don't have. Yeah. And they are things like time, you know, enough time to sit down and write 100, 120,000 words. And a place to write, you know, somewhere where you can go away and hide if you want. And I think more importantly, a place to write about. And when I did start trying to write books quite early on, you know, when I was sort of back in my 20s, when I was working as a journalist, funnily enough, one of the things that eluded me, or it was harder to try and track down even more than time, was a place to write about. And I think what happens as life goes on, you get to a stage, number one, where you realise, if I don't try this, I'm going to run out of time. So that builds and builds and builds. And then I think you have to have an element of luck. And I was lucky that I kind of went on a holiday to Africa in 95 and got hooked on the continent and a number of the different countries there. And I found my place to write about. And I was also at the stage where I was married and I had a very supportive wife who said, well, you can take 6 months off work and go and try and write a book. So following your dream requires quite a lot of logistics and I think determination and luck, I think.
What about the experience side of things? Because, you know, when you're a kid, you're in your early 20s or your late teens and you go, I'm going to write a book. What's going to be in this book?
Yeah.
There's no real life experience. And a lot of writers, you know, you've got to deal with characters who are different to you. You've got to deal with circumstances you may not know about personally. You know, and you know, having waited or having lived a little bit before you actually put pen to paper, it's got to help.
Yeah, I think there's an often quoted adage that says, write about what you know. Mm. Well, you've got to know some stuff first. Yeah. You know? And so I embrace that. I mean, my books have featured characters who were journalists, because I used to work as a journalist, and characters who have travelled in the continent of Africa, and particularly in the earlier books I was writing, a lot of the characters in there were characters who were not from the continent but discovering it, either through work or tourism. That very much reflected my experience, and these days I try and I'm always trying to learn more about where I live in Africa and the people around where I live and the cultures, and I try and bring more of that in. So I'm still drawing on life experience. I think, yes, it's good to have been a few places and done a few things. It's not to say that you have to wait that long, but I think as I was experimenting and trying to find the time while working day jobs to write, I was also, whether I knew it or not, gaining experiences. Mm. And one thing that did help me, having worked as a journalist, was that you meet a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. And that gave me, I guess, a desire to learn more about characters, more about people. And that's something I still follow these days. I research by talking, by interviewing people, much the same way as I used to do as a journalist.
So talk about that journalism. What sort of journalism were you doing? What sort of stories were you?
I worked on local newspapers. I was doing the police rounds. I was doing the council meetings. I was doing the drink drivers in the local court cases and a little bit of local politics. One thing I worked out very early on as a journalist that I realised that I loved writing. And so I hoped that I was on the right career path. But I wasn't a very good reporter. You know, I wasn't a foot in the door person. Yeah. You know, I was never going to end up working for a hard hitting, you know, daily newspaper or on Current Affair or something like that. I liked features. I liked meeting people and I liked talking to people. So if I'm talking to people who are interested in writing their own book, and quite often the question of research comes up, I say, rather than spending time on the internet or going through endless research books, talk to people that know about the stuff that you want to put into your book and, you know, interview them. And I find people are incredibly giving. So what I learned as a journalist was how to talk to people, how to get them to tell me my stories. And that's how I do a lot of my research.
That's very interesting, because I've interviewed other writers, very successful writers, who are very similar in that line. I don't actually drawn them all together. You just sort of, you're pointing it out there. But that, when I remember Jeffrey Deaver was talking about it, they go and interview these people. They go into the real world and sit across from them and then ask them questions. And sometimes they don't even know they're getting interviewed.
Sure, yeah.
It's just a chat. You know, yeah. They meet someone interesting and they start chatting and they end up getting all this wonderful information.
Yeah, I find the other thing that helps for me is to kind of do my research retrospectively. Mm-hmm. So I will sit down and write a book. Yeah. When I don't have a plot, I just have a premise to start off with and I write the book from start to finish. And if I don't know something, I just put check in there, in bold.
Yeah.
And after I finish writing the book, I then go and look for experts who can help me check my facts and fill in those blanks. And I find that's a good approach, I think, because you're not wasting the time of the person you're talking to. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to sit down and say to a scientist, tell me how to make an atomic bomb. Not that they feature in my books, but if I write a book and there's a scientist in there who makes atomic bombs, maybe I need three or four facts or pieces of information or anecdotes from them to make that character more realistic. The new book's got a vet in it, mm-hmm. So I wrote a book about a wildlife vet in captive, and he has to perform a few procedures on wild animals during the book. But rather than sitting down with one of the two vets who I subsequently met and say, how do you do this, how do you do that, how do you fix this animal, how do you do that, before I started writing, I came to them later and I had very specific questions. So it saved us all a lot of time.
But also, I mean, if you're talking about research on the internet or in books, that's information that everyone has access to. If you go straight to the source and they're just telling you it, and it's just whatever comes off the top of their head, and it's your unique source.
And it's real, and it tends to be more accurate. The other thing I found with the internet, when I have lapsed, you know, I have got lazy, and I've used the internet to check the odd little piece of information, and I've got it wrong, because everything's on the internet, not all of it's right.
Yeah.
So I think it helps to talk to someone who is an expert in their particular field, and ideally, and I've been very lucky with this as well, because a couple of veterinarians read Captive, is to get them to read the manuscript. And you know yourself, if you're reading a novel in particular, and it touches on a subject that you know on your job or your profession, if that novelist has got one thing wrong, the tiniest thing wrong, it leaps out at you off the page, and it can undermine the rest of the story.
Yeah, if you doubt everything, you know, how can they know this, how can they know
exactly,
that?
Then calls into question all the other facts. Yeah. So the only way to avoid that is, if you're lucky enough, is to get someone who's not only helped you, but say, would you mind reading the book for me? And I rely on that in all my novels.
Tony, I've been very selfish. I've wandered into your backstory because I'm always interested in how writers work. Without actually talking about the book, can you tell me about Captive?
Yeah, Captive set in modern-day South Africa. It touches, once again, like some of my previous books, on the war against poaching. Elephants and rhinos and many other animals, creatures large and small, are still being killed, generally for money, for commercial trade in their bodies and their body parts for various purposes. This is told from the perspective of a wildlife veterinarian who gets involved in a gun battle with poachers. His name is Graham, and unfortunately the poacher that he shoots is the brother of a poaching kingpin, and he gets locked up in jail in Mozambique. He was supposed to be meeting up with a young Australian wildlife volunteer, Kerry Maxwell, travelling to Africa for her first time experience to go and save the continent's wildlife, and she happens to be a lawyer, so she comes to his rescue and tries to get him out of jail, but they draw the attention of the poachers and spend the rest of the book trying to fight them off. The subplot in the book, though, is something that I'm also quite interested in and quite passionate in, and that's the roles of charities and non-government organisations on the continent of Africa and particularly in respect to wildlife conservation, because there are many different charities and NGOs there, and they find themselves competing not only for a shrinking charity dollar for resources, but they're very competitive often in terms of their philosophies and their approach that they take to conserving things like rhinos and elephants, and can find themselves in conflict, in quite strident conflict. And that struck me as a good basis for a book, because you have a lot of people on the continent trying to do good, sometimes not doing the best job, but quite often in conflict with each other. So I've woven that into the story as well.
And your experience of those kind of things, I know that you do a bit of the safari stuff. You go out there and you're friends with Peter Allison.
Yes,
Who wrote those funny books.
Indeed, yeah, he's a great writer, Peter. Very funny guy, yeah.
How much of that is still part of your life? How much of... Because I see on your Facebook and all that sort of stuff, you're going out into the bush
Yeah, I'm lucky. Where my wife and I live is on a little game reserve on the edge of the Kruger Park. So we very much live side by side with wild animals. You know, we get elephants around the house every now and then. We have a resident leopard that lives around the house, and lions visit occasionally. We've always got zebra and giraffe and hyenas around. And it might sound a bit blasé, but the fact is that with a little bit of consideration and a little bit of respect and a little bit of knowledge, is that humans and wildlife can exist side by side. Mm. And you know, one of the greatest threats to wildlife, not just in Africa, around the world, including Australia, is human encroachment and habitat loss, which is a big problem.
Yeah.
But if we all take a kind of sensible approach and realise the importance of the natural environment, you know, of the forests and the jungles and the wildlife, and we stop, you know, raising vegetation to the ground and inadvertently sending species extinct because we're building too many houses and things, we can live side by side with them. And I guess that's something subtly that I try to get across in the books, and I'm quite passionate about. So yeah, that lifestyle that I lead is part of the life that's reflected in the books. Yeah.
So at the moment, there's a drought where you are.
Very serious down in Cape Town in the southern part of the South.
And the water's running out. Yeah. What is it? I mean, When you found your subject of Africa, when you really found a subject, because there's the politics, there's the animals, there's the conservation, there's the results of the colonialism, there's all these things which are still there and still very much, and there's the different cultures that are jammed into one, you know, these sort of the lines drawn on the map by people in London 150 years ago or something, but you're living there in South Africa, and South Africa is going right now. It's going through some political upheaval with
changes in presidency
and the corruption. So how does that affect the way you write? Because it's almost like you've got too much to write about.
Yeah, you're right. Well, I mean, if people have asked me in the past, do I ever think I'll run out of ideas? It's impossible.
Yeah.
Because even if you look at where I spend a lot of time, which tends to be Southern Africa, in the Cull, the last book, I ventured up into East Africa. The diversity is amazing anyway, with the different cultures and the different landscapes and things. So there's that differentiation anyway. So it's a vast continent, and even within any country in Africa, you have so many different cultures, so many different habitats and things. So there's plenty of basic stuff to write about. But if you looked at the earlier books that I wrote, Far Horizon and Zambezi and African Sky, the countries that I wrote about there, if you take Zimbabwe and South Africa and Botswana and Zambia, those countries are radically different today to what they were 14 years ago.
Mm.
Some better, some worse.
Yeah.
You know, because the politics, when you overlay politics over all those existing cultural and environmental differences, it's a roller coaster, John.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it goes crazy. I wrote about Rwanda, which in 1994, after the genocide, in which 800,000 people have been slaughtered often by their friends and neighbours, by ordinary people in the space of 6 weeks. You could not imagine a country that had descended so far into hell or beyond, if that's possible. If you look at that country today, in the space of a very short period of time, just over 20 years, it has the highest proportion of women in parliament. It's peaceful, it's harmonious, everybody in the country does a day's volunteer work a month, community service. It has no plastic bags at all whatsoever, and it has reinvented itself completely differently to what it was. And yet other countries in that same time have suffered and gone downhill. So you can never run out of stuff to write about. You can never run out of ideas.
And is there any pet, I know that Peter Allison is very much involved in the rhinos. Is there something that you are really passionate about that you have as a project that just continues on, or is it all over the place?
I've considered myself very fortunate in that I always wanted to try and help in some way, but I didn't know what to do. I'm not a particularly practical person, but I, through the books, I've met an incredible number of people, and this is a point I do want to stress, is that I've met a number of people who do work for charities and NGOs who are doing an absolutely fantastic job to help people and wildlife on the continent of Africa. And I'm the patron of a group called Painted Dog Conservation, which is aimed at protecting the African painted dog. And I've recently got involved with a group of people who support a hospital called Heal Africa in the Congo. And they're working in Goma, an area that's quite often rocketed and mortared and finds itself on the front line of political and tribal conflicts in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And yet ordinary Aussies, doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, teachers, go over there to try and help the people of that country. And I met another lady the other day, Lucy Hopgood Brown, from a tiny charity called Hand Up Congo that supports a school and a clinic in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And she basically runs it by herself from Sydney. To get to the village that she helps out, she flies to Johannesburg, and she gets a connecting flight to Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo. She travels 18 hours by boat, by canoe, and then treks for about 3 hours to get to this village, where she helps out in the local school, raises money, helps the local community, and helps train people in emergency medicine up there. So I find that quite inspirational. So I think one of the things I am lucky is that I get to meet some really special people doing some really good things. More often than not, they're not part of big international organisations or aid organisations. They're ordinary people working in their, more often than not, where I live in South Africa, in their own town or their own village to try and change things. And sometimes they're helped by good people from overseas who come and give their time.
Do you ever hear from people who have read your books and have decided to travel to Africa and see what it's all about? Do you have that flow-on effect?
Yeah, it's really rewarding. Yeah, it is, yeah. I was helping out a reader the other day who wants to go and volunteer at a rhino conservation project in Zimbabwe, which I referred him on to, and I got a nice email from a couple who went on their honeymoon to one of the game lodges that I mentioned in one of my books, in The Hunter, which I think was the last one that I spoke to you about. And I got a lovely email from an 89-year-old lady a couple of months ago who said it had been her life's dream to go to Africa, but she'd never been able to pluck up the courage, in her words. And she emailed me and I said, "You'll be fine. This is what you should do and this is where you should go." And she went and she loved it, which I think is a great feeling to be able to reach out to people.
Yeah. Well, you said you're not very practical. You're actually doing some very practical work with your with your books. I mean, because it is such an amazing way to get into people's brains, the novel, you know, and to give them a kind of a experience of it that gives them that first step or that little trial run, like a virtual reality. You know, what could it be like if they don't want to get into the trouble that you
probably not
fall into
in
your books, but there are quieter moments.
Exactly. I do like to share my love of the continent, and try and showcase the good where I can as well too. I think unfortunately, in a country like Australia, we get a lot of our news from the continent through a lens, narrow lens, literally, through one TV camera with one reporter from the ABC in Africa. Mm. And sadly, a lot of the news, therefore, by definition, focuses on things that are going wrong. But there's a lot of stuff going right. And as I said, more often than not, it's being generated from the grassroots level. So I do like to try and show that. And the other thing we're able to do is help organisations raise a bit of money. I've auctioned off the names of characters in my last few books for various causes where people pay money to have their names used as characters. So pretty well all the names in this new book and the last half dozen have been people who've paid money to various causes.
Can I ask you a few questions about, just to finish off here, a few questions about what it is that makes a good thriller? Because you've been doing it for... successfully for years now, and you're a best-selling author in this area, and it's that you write page-turning books. What is it? Is it something that you don't even know you're doing? It just happens, or is it something you? Are there any tips for anyone out there who wants to write?
If there's any tips, I think you just have to love it. You have to love doing it. Yeah, this is not something that you can get involved. So I'm going to write a book because I'm going to make a lot of money.
Yeah,
it's not going to happen. Yeah. If you slog away at it for 15 years, you might be able to make a living. You know?
All those overnight successes.
Unless, some people do break through and they have an overnight success. Yeah. But I'm not a sporting person, John, but I do use a sporting analogy. I like to run. I like to run. I like to swim. You know, I'm not into competitive sports. But there's no point in my life where I've ever thought that I'm going to win a marathon or I'm going to swim for Australia. Mm. But I write and I run and I swim because I like it.
Yeah.
And I say to people, only write if you like it.
Yeah.
You know? And if you like it, even if you don't get published or you don't get it right first time or the 20th time, if you've enjoyed the process, then that's a win. And I've always said, I get very nervous. I get very worried every time I submit a book. I get terrified that it's not going to be accepted because I don't want my bubble to burst. Mm. I have a lovely, lovely life. But I can tell you hand on heart that if that ever did happen to me, as it will one day, that I'll keep writing because I love it.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is, rather than saying, I'm going to write a thriller or I'm going to write a literary masterpiece because I want to win the Miles Franklin. That's going to make me sell more copies or something like that. Write about what you love and write the sort of book that you want to read. I like reading thrillers with a little bit of action and romance and a strong female lead. And that's the sort of books that I write because that's the sort of books that I like reading. So I think you've got to enjoy it. And in that respect, you have to stay true to yourself.
That's a brilliant point to end with. Thank you very much for coming and talking to us, Tony.
Thanks, John.
That was great. I love the final analogy. That's just marvellous, about like the running and the swimming.
Thank you.
And you can get hold of all of Tony Park's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.